Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy, who discusses his group's just-released annual State of the Dream report, focusing on the vast racial disparities in Americans' access to health care. Mark Jacobson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University, who argues that the entire world could transition to renewable energy, including solar, wind, and geothermal, by the middle of this century. And Todd O'Boyle of Common Cause, who assesses the recent federal court ruling overturning FCC rules on net neutrality and the options now for new regulations to preserve an open internet. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the days after Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan signed a harsh same-sex marriage prohibition act, which makes it a crime to attend a meeting of a gay organization or belong to a gay social club, police in northern Nigeria are rounding up gay men. Dorothy Akinwunmi of Nigeria's International Center for Reproductive Health and Sexual Rights claims police in predominantly Muslim Bachi state arrested 38 men in early January and had a list of 168 others to detain. The activists said the gay men were tortured until they turned over more names of people belonging to gay organizations. Bachi state officials employed a civil penal code and Sharia, or Islamic courts, to deal with violations of the new anti-gay law. Nigeria's new law imposes penalties of up to 14 years in jail for same-sex marriage and up to 10 years imprisonment for membership or encouragement of gay clubs and organizations, including groups formed to combat AIDS and support HIV prevention measures. Mother Jones magazine reports the popular internet forum Reddit has emerged into a marketplace to buy and sell assault rifles, high-capacity magazines, and other firearms. Over the last 6 months, there were over 1,000 guns posted for sale, including over 100 AR-15 rifles engraved with a Reddit logo. In May 2011, Reddit, then owned by Condé Nast, authorized its logo to be placed on assault rifles. In September 2013, an active gun seller on Reddit, known as Firearm Concierge, posted SCAR-16 combat assault rifles manufactured for U.S. Special Operations Forces for sale, selling at $2,300 each. Instructions posted on Reddit urge buyers and sellers to comply with federal and state laws, but Mother Jones found posts which appeared to exploit loopholes around the online sales of firearms, allowing people to avoid federal background checks. Reddit executives say they do not monitor commercial transactions between their users. While major internet companies like Google, Amazon, and eBay have halted gun sales on their sites, Reddit has taken a hands-off attitude, allowing the arms traffic to continue without interference. The Los Angeles City Council is debating a new proposal to raise wages at larger hotels to over $15 an hour. But the proposal faces stiff opposition from hotel owners and the downtown LA business community, who complain the law will force them to raise prices. The raise to $15 an hour for hotel workers is double the current federal minimum wage. The proposal would cover hotels with over 100 rooms and boost the wages of housekeepers, busboys, and maintenance workers. City Councilor Paul Koretz told the Los Angeles Times the $15 an hour wage is reasonable in a city where costs are so high. The city's 2007 living wage law applied to workers at Los Angeles Airport and 13 hotels located there, where an $11.97 an hour wage floor was enforced. The Unite Here Union's Local 11 and its progressive allies have won the backing of 750 local business owners who support the wage hike for hotel workers with a goal of boosting LA's economy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
This year's holiday, honoring the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., comes as a national debate is gathering momentum on how to address growing income inequality. Although Dr. King is widely known for his accomplishments on civil rights and his famous I Have a Dream speech, what many Americans don't know is this social justice champion was also a leader in supporting union rights, challenging corporate power, and government policies that exacerbated poverty and economic inequality. Dr. King also took an uncompromising and controversial stand in opposition to the Vietnam War and Cold War militarism. In a new report published on this year's Martin Luther King holiday, the group United for a Fair Economy examined racial disparities in Americans' healthcare outcomes. The report, titled State of the Dream 2014, Healthcare for Whom? Enduring Racial Disparities, is the group's 11th annual MLK Day report, which documents the heavy toll that continued racial segregation and concentrated poverty takes on people's health. The report looks at impoverished communities' inadequate healthcare facilities, full-service grocery stores, green spaces, and disproportionate exposure to toxic chemicals and industrial pollutants. Your reporter spoke with Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy and author of the State of the Dream report, who focuses on the decision by 25 state governors to oppose expansion of the Medicaid program under the Obamacare health reform law, denying health insurance to nearly 5 million citizens, disproportionately people of color.
I think it's no great mystery to the listeners of your show that the Tea Party wing and the Republicans in general have done everything they can to undermine the Affordable Care Act, which is also commonly known as Obamacare. They shut down the federal government last year in an effort to dismantle the program. They failed, but they're succeeding at the state level in undermining the plan. In particular, the Supreme Court ruling last year gave states the option it basically stated that they did not have to expand their Medicaid program. And as a result, the right wing has been organizing governors and state assemblies to oppose expansion of Medicaid at the state level. And 25 states, as of now, have rejected the Medicaid expansion, including the entire South, with the exception of Arkansas, and a bunch of states in the northern mountains, you know, the Dakotas and so on, and a few other stragglers, including Maine and New Hampshire, actually, in our neck of the woods. The impact of this is that, generally speaking, any rejection of Medicaid is going to disproportionately hit people of color, because people of color were lagging behind in insurance coverage to begin with. But in particular, because all the states in the South, with the exception of Arkansas again, and if you know anything about demographics, there's what people call the Black Belt, right? It stretches from Virginia down to Georgia and across to Louisiana and Arkansas, where you've got massive numbers of counties and places where the counties are 25% to 50% or more African American. So you have large sections of the country where African Americans live that are rejecting health care expansion for low-income families in their state. As a result, African Americans represent only 13% of the nation's population, but they are 27% of the people who are going to lose health care because of the GOP's 25-state coverage gap. Similarly, Latinos are impacted, particularly because Texas and Florida have rejected Medicaid expansion. And as a result, Latinos, 15% of the population, once you take out undocumented immigrants, who aren't covered in the original ACA, yet they account for 21% of those who fall through this 25-state coverage gap. Part of the reason Latinos aren't hit as hard is because, fortunately, states like New Mexico, Arizona, California have expanded their Medicaid program. Nonetheless, Latinos still are disproportionately impacted by this decision, or these decisions, I should say.
How does the rejection from these 25 states of the expansion of Medicaid disproportionately affecting people of color, how does that affect our society as a whole, the fabric of our society, given that this is a wide swath of the country that's being affected?
One of the things we talk about in the report is health, in addition to being a fundamental moral issue. You know, there's a great quote, I think I mentioned by Dr. King, of all forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. There's moral implications to lack of health insurance. There's also significant economic impacts to lack of health care insurance, both for society, because when people show up at the emergency room, they're still going to get covered and the costs get passed on. But more importantly, in this case, for the people, because, you know, when people don't have health insurance, what happens is they mount up medical debt, which leads to bankruptcy, which leads to greater wealth loss. And these are communities that are already suffering, that are already getting kicked. And so it fuels this vicious cycle, you know. And one of the things we talk about in the report is sort of the way, you know, a way to understand the way patterns of racial inequity have been ingrained in our society, and one system impacts the other system, impacts the other system. One could argue there's nothing inherently racist about an employer-based healthcare system. But, now, we could argue a whole lot of reasons it's terrible, but, you know, from a race standpoint, you could also argue there's nothing inherently racist about it. Nonetheless, it generates highly racialized outcomes because it's based on an employment sector where there's well-documented racial discrimination, where there's well-documented disparities in employment. So as a result, 29% of Latinos lack health insurance, 19% of African Americans lack health insurance, versus 11% of whites. So you have these vast disparities of health care. As long as this health care system depends upon the employment system to determine who gets health care and who doesn't, we're going to have these disparities. And that's why in the report we really make the case for a single-payer system, which breaks out of that paradigm. And if you look at those 65 and older, there's no disparities in health insurance by race. None. It's 99.5% of whites have health insurance, 99.5% of blacks have health insurance of those 65 and older. Why? Because we have a single-payer system for seniors in this country. And we make the case for a universal single-payer system. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act stops short of that. But what it does do is, a lot of folks are familiar with the health insurance exchanges that get all the media. That's for really the middle-income and lower-middle-income families that don't get health care through their work. The other provision of the Affordable Care Act is expanding the Medicaid program for low-income families up to 138% of poverty. And that one program right there would extend health care to 10 million Americans if it were allowed to be fully implemented. Fully half of those who would have gotten insurance are no longer going to get it because of this state-by-state GOP assault. And that's what we really talk about, one of the many things we talk about in this year's State of the Dream report, which your listeners can download it at faireconomy.org/dream.
That was Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy and author of the 2014 State of the Dream report on Americans' healthcare outcomes. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to download a copy of the report and additional analysis and commentary. Because there's been almost no progress on addressing climate change in either national or international venues, a report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change leaked last week predicts that tackling the ever more catastrophic weather events occurring with increasing frequency will be much more costly than if action had been taken 2 decades or even 2 years ago. The report maintains that it's too late in some cases for humans to adapt to these changes in climate. The UN report also observes that governments of the world are still spending far more money to subsidize fossil fuels than to accelerate the shift to cleaner energy, thus encouraging continued investment in projects like coal-burning power plants that pose a long-term climate risk. Mark Jacobson, a senior fellow with the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment and professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University, co-authored a study with scientists from Cornell University and the University of California, Davis, titled A Path to Sustainable Energy by 2050. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Professor Jacobson, who argues that the entire world could transition to renewable energy, including solar, wind, and geothermal, by the middle of this century, without resorting to nuclear power or the use of any fossil fuels. Here he explains how it could be accomplished and what obstacles are standing in the way of taking action on implementing the plan.
Well, I think it's true that climate change is a serious problem, and it's actually much worse than most people think. And so it's extremely important to address it quickly. I think there are solutions to the problems that can be implemented, not only today, but over time, and even as population grows, the solutions can all still be implemented. The idea would be to change the energy infrastructure of the world for all purposes, that's electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, and industrial processes, to from combustion to one based on wind, water, and solar power, and so electricity really for all purposes. And so, for example, gasoline and diesel vehicles would be converted to electric vehicles, and in some cases, hydrogen fuel cell, where the hydrogen is produced from electricity. And for heating and cooling, we'd use like air source and ground source heat pumps instead of gas heaters or oil-based heaters. And same thing for high-temperature processes, we'd use electric resistance. And the electricity generation would all be based on wind power and solar power, a little bit of geothermal, existing hydroelectric, so not much growth at all of hydroelectric, but using it more efficiently, and tiny amount of wave and tidal power offshore. So no nuclear power, no natural gas, no biofuels, and no coal with carbon capture or clean coal. So this is entirely clean and renewable. And the goal of this would not only be to eliminate global warming, but also to eliminate air pollution, which, because worldwide 2.5 to 4 million people die every year from air pollution from combustion, and this would be effectively eliminated by this conversion. And then the final benefit, aside from creating jobs and producing, implementing this infrastructure, would be to stabilize prices of energy, because the cost of fuel for wind and solar in particular are zero, whereas the cost of fuel for all fossil fuels is non-zero and gradually rising over time. And so there's already data available in the U.S. and other places about how large-scale implementation of wind stabilizes the price of energy. And we can give an example in the 10 states in the United States with the highest fraction of penetration from wind. During the last 10 years, the price of electricity in those states went up only 3 cents a kilowatt hour. In the rest of the states, it went up 4 cents a kilowatt hour.
Well, I know in recent years, natural gas has actually dropped in price, but I understand that longer term, fossil fuels will rise in price as more and more of them get consumed.
If we take the risk where we wait until the prices rise so high, it might be too late to do such a conversion because the prices will rise so fast, you might get economic and political instability and chaos in a country before there's a chance to change the energy infrastructure. So we have to look ahead and see to prevent that from happening. So if we can stabilize the prices by converting to the solar and wind, for example, now, that would eliminate a potential future catastrophe of political and social instability.
Mark Jacobson, it seems like both the U.S. and other parts of the world, like China, are pursuing two tracks simultaneously. You know, that is, they are building more renewables, like solar and wind, but they're also using more fossil fuels. And in the case of China, it's coal, which is the worst fossil fuel of all, both in terms of air pollution and in terms of its carbon footprint.
Well, there has been progress, and naturally, but we need it to be faster. For example, in 2012, more than 50% of all new electric power in the U.S. was wind plus solar. In Europe, it was over 68%. In last year, 2013, 28% of all electricity in Iowa and South Dakota was produced by wind power. We've developed a really detailed plan for New York. We've developed one for California and for Washington. We also did a world plan and a U.S. plan as a whole, and we're developing plans for individual states. And with this information, they can hopefully make better decisions.
Since you know how dire this situation is, how do you maintain your optimism?
Well, globally, we need to lead by example. So if we can get certain either states or small countries to actually go forward in this direction, then people will learn about the economic benefits of doing such a conversion in terms of stabilizing prices and creating jobs and then cleaning the air and the reduced health costs of cleaning the air from such a conversion. For example, I mentioned that 2.5 to 4 million people die prematurely each year from air pollution. Well, in the U.S., that results in a cost of anywhere from 3 to 7% of the GDP of the entire United States for the 50 to 100,000 people who die every year in the U.S. prematurely from air pollution. So there is a cost benefit and also a climate cost benefit that improves the economic well-being of individuals in every single country by making such a conversion. And once this is shown more concretely in individual states and even small countries, then larger countries would also want to take part because they're going to realize this economic benefit as well. So I'm pretty optimistic there will be a change, although there are significant barriers, mostly political and social, not technical or economic, for changing the energy infrastructure.
That was Mark Jacobson, a senior fellow with the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment and professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. Find links to his Path to Sustainable Energy report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an action that could dramatically change the way millions of Americans access the Internet, a Washington, D.C. appeals court threw out the Federal Communications Commission's rules on the important principle known as net neutrality. The FCC regulations, invalidated by the court in a January 14th ruling, had mandated an even playing field for all Internet users and content producers. Now, with these rules no longer in place, Internet service providers and giant telecommunications and cable companies like Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, and Time Warner can both block certain Internet websites and/or charge customers additional fees to gain access to specific sites. These companies can now also slow down or speed up their customers' access to streaming movies, software, and other data, depending on the amount of money charged. Civil liberties and media democracy activists have long warned that FCC rules on net neutrality were weak and open to challenge. Now, with this court ruling, open Internet advocates are calling on newly appointed FCC Chair Thomas Wheeler, a former cable and wireless lobbyist, to immediately change the Commission's classification of broadband from an information service to a telecommunications service. However, this move would likely trigger loud and angry opposition from the biggest players in the cable and phone industry. Your reporter spoke with Todd O'Boyle, Program Director for Media and Democracy at Common Cause, who assesses the recent federal court decision overturning FCC rules on net neutrality and the options now for new regulations to preserve an open Internet.
The basic idea is that if you're a network provider, an Internet service provider, say, you have to serve up content, take customers where they want to go, connect them to the services and applications of their choice on a non-discriminatory basis. What that means is that I, as a network provider, cannot create a fast lane for my select business partners and leave everybody else in a slow lane. So if you can imagine, your listeners should be a good way of thinking about this is that the local independent bookstore, you should be able to visit their webpage with the same responsiveness as the as Amazon.com or something like that. And what the court said was that the FCC's rules that prevent this sort of deal-making and these fast lanes, the rules that prevent service providers from blocking consumer access to content, were not valid as they were written. But the good thing here is that the court told the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, a different set of rules would pass judicial muster. So what we're asking the FCC to do is to write rules that will withstand litigation, will withstand judicial scrutiny.
Todd, for our listeners' benefit and mine, give us some examples of how net neutrality would protect us from some future form of second-class citizenship, both for users, Internet users, and Internet content providers.
Sure. A good way to think about this is to think about the way that the traditional telephone network works. If I'm a small business person, I advertise for my services, and if anyone wants to get a hold of me, they can just punch in my number and the call will be connected in a neutral fashion. However, that's a net neutrality world. In a different world, every link in the chain in the world of the network and the wires and all the connections, the providers, the people that own that infrastructure, could start working out deals and say, well, I'm not going to connect your traffic unless you pay enough. And you can start erecting what you might think of as toll booths all along the Internet. And what this means is that the principle of anyone can get started online, anyone can put something up online, anyone can connect to basically anyone else is now dependent on, well, who's going to pay the piper?
Todd, explain to our listeners, what exactly does the FCC have to do in order to change these rules to pass muster with the judicial branch?
Sure. It's a little technical, but basically we're asking the FCC to revisit a mistake it made in the past. In the early 2000s, the FCC decided that it was going to deregulate broadband and leave it without any consumer protections. They so-called classified broadband as an information service, telecommunication services have fuller protection. And while this gets a little jargony, the court ruled that you cannot name broadband an information service and try and write consumer protection on top of it. So if they just revisit that mistake they made and decide that broadband is what we all know it to be, which is a telecommunication service, then there would be no question about their ability to write strong consumer protections in the law.
Given that the telecommunications companies around the country stand to make so much money if this abrogation of the FCC rule stands, how much pressure do you think they're going to exert on the FCC and the Obama administration to leave this situation alone and not impose new rules to enforce net neutrality?
Well, I have no doubt in my mind that they are going to deploy some of the best paid lobbyists in Washington, D.C. But I also know that there's good strong precedent for citizen action making a difference at the Federal Communications Commission. So immediately after this decision, there has been a raucous outpouring of public support. We've seen our petition has gathered tens of thousands of signatures. And just on Thursday, the chairman of the FCC said, we will protect the open Internet, and we're hoping that he follows through on that. So we're going to be delivering our petition to help him understand just how vital this issue is and to let him know that we take it very seriously.
The new FCC chair, as I understand it, Thomas Wheeler, is a guy who himself was a telecommunications lobbyist, if I'm not mistaken. How much do you have faith that he'll follow through on that commitment to preserve net neutrality despite this court decision?
Well, I don't think any chairman of the FCC is going to do anything that's going to upset the industry without strong pressure from the public. And so I think this isn't a question of Mr. Wheeler's resume. I think we would be exerting the exact same pressure on the FCC right now with a different chair. So what really matters is that people add their voices and make sure that everyone in Washington, D.C. knows just how important this issue is.
That was Todd O'Boyle, Program Director for Media and Democracy at Common Cause. For more information and analysis on issues related to net neutrality, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.